Reverend Madsen, let me begin with you. In one of your sermons, and I spent a lot of time this afternoon listening to you, you are a gifted preacher. I'm going to have to come visit your church. In one of your sermons, you said, God is not the God of our past, but the God of our future. Certainly during Dr. King's time, the black church played a crucial role in the civil rights movement. The church wasn't just this inanimate object, but it was a living, breathing tool of activism, and it served as a safe haven and a hub where strategies took place. But today, one of the biggest criticisms of the black church is that it's stagnant, that it doesn't do enough for the issues of justice that affect all people, but especially African Americans, since the black church is so crucial to the lives of many African Americans. So how would you respond to that? And how do you see the black church evolving? And what do you see its role today as addressing these issues of social justice that affect folks inside and outside of your congregation?
Yes, thank you, and it's an honor to be here with other panelists and to see you this evening. I think that some of the criticism directed toward the current black church, and when we say black church, we're saying a lot, because I don't know if there's such a thing as the black church, but I think that there is an expression, a tradition within the black church that traditionally has been a prophetic voice in America. And we must not forget that Dr. King came out of the black church, and it was what I call his spiritual incubator. And he first probably went to Sunday school and heard stories and parables from the Bible about the oppressed. He knew the story of the Israelites in slavery. He knew the parable of the Good Samaritan and the rich man and poor man, Dives and Lazarus. And it was out of the Judeo-Christian faith that he was nurtured in a situation where the black church was a prophetic voice and, in many instances, the conscience of America. I think that, to some extent, that has been lost today because, in some instances, not just the black church, but many of our institutions have bought into a prosperity-driven theology and bought into the American idea of success, and we have abandoned the prophetic emphasis and no longer do we speak for the masses. I think that it's important for the black church to recover that so that we can again have that voice that speaks to the pain and frustration of men and women, boys and girls in such unjust environment in which we live.
Do you do that behind the pulpit?
I think it's important that, because I think it's important to remember too that part of Dr. King's genius was his oratory. Words are important, and not only what we would say, not just what you say, but how you say it. And he was able to move the masses through oratory, not empty words, but meetings and speaking opportunities all across the South, gathering in black churches, and the power of his words was so effective that translated into meaningful action. So that when he finished speaking, people were ready to march. People were ready to protest. I think there's a case to be made that even today, oratory can be a powerful tool in pricking the conscience of America. If you look at major rallies that are held today, they're speeches. Somebody's saying something, and how they say it, the words that are chosen, can greatly influence the power and influence of that movement.
I want to get back to that, but I'm going to have to. I'm moving on to Abby, Reverend Tennis, and ask her the hard, honest question that we talked about. So let's go back about 50 years or more to the March on Washington in 1963. Tens of thousands of whites joined the hundreds of thousands of African Americans, which was essential then to march strategy. It was critical that those whites in middle America who were watching the civil rights movement on TV just didn't see civil rights as a Negro thing, but that, as organizer Bayard Rustin said, whites couldn't sit on the fence anymore. Civil rights meant rights for all people, and everybody had to be invested in the rights for one, which would be the rights for all. Of course, we all know that confronting racism shouldn't fall solely on the group that's being oppressed by racism, but so often that's what happens. Whites ignore it, thereby reinforcing it. So blacks' biggest rallying cry lately is that white people have to get their hands dirty, and not just when it's convenient for them to do so. But that's the benefit of white privilege, right? You can pick and choose how involved you want to be. An example of that would be that many whites are ready to protest after a mass shooting, but where's the outcry when black children get killed in their neighborhood every single day? Abby, through your social justice ministry, you have worked your entire professional life for equal rights. But those who feel morally obligated to join the fight for whites, what's the most effective way? And can white privilege be used as a weapon for the cause?
Well, first I wanted to thank you very much for inviting me here, and it's a huge honor to be here with my co-panelists. So the first question was, what's the most effective way for us to be involved? So I'm a Unitarian Universalist pastor, and as a Unitarian Universalist, some of the things that guide my faith are a belief in the inherent worth and dignity of every person, a commitment to working for justice, equity, and compassion throughout my life, and respect for the interdependence of all life. And if that doesn't mean that I am engaged in the work to tear down the oppression that privileges me, then I'm not living out my faith. And I think that that's true for all of us. You know, Dr. King said, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere, and that all our liberation is bound up together. So to pretend that there's an issue that's not my issue is being false to myself. And pretend that this issue is not more my responsibility than my colleagues of color, than fellow panelists who are of color, is absurd, because I'm the one who is benefiting from it every day. So there's a million ways that we need to get involved. the thing that I've been thinking about as we've begun preparing for this panel today was Dr. King's letter from a Birmingham jail. And I don't know, this was something that I didn't always know, but Dr. King's letter from a Birmingham jail, so he wrote it Good Friday, 1963, while he's in jail, because a friend of his had smuggled in a newspaper. And on that newspaper, there was an open letter from eight white clergy, Christian and Jewish clergy from Alabama, I'm assuming progressive clergy, and it was called A Call to Unity. And if you read this letter, it's like, let's all be loving, let's all work together for justice. It's really important for us to be moving forward in this fight. But they were saying that Dr. King was moving too fast, that he was pushing too hard, that that he should have been going through the proper channels, that he should have been negotiating with politicians. And so Dr. King wrote, you know, writes the letter from the Birmingham jail that says he was beginning to think that the greatest stumbling block to African-American freedom was not the Ku Klux Klan, it was not white supremacists, but was the white moderate. And those are my people. I'm a Massachusetts kid. You know, everybody in my family is a Democrat. My congregation, I would say, is probably all left of center to far left. And we're a multiracial congregation, but we're mostly white. And so, to me, a lot of our work is, you know, is listening to the words of Dr. King from 55 years ago, that could have been written today, and it could have been written about me. That it's very easy for white people to want to say, oh, no, Asa, you're going too fast, you're going too hard, and you should just be working with politicians, you shouldn't be protesting. And so part of what my job is to not seek first to be a leader in the movement, but seek first to listen, and seek first to listen to people of color and follow their leadership. And lift up their voices whenever possible, because it's also very easy for my people, and I'm saying white people, to dismiss people of color's voices, or to dismiss experiences and just say like, oh no, that she didn't mean that, you know, that was just a joke. Oh, she's really nice usually. She must have been having a bad day. And when it's a daily experience of when you're experiencing racism on a daily basis, and every single time it gets dismissed by some white person by saying that, oh no, that person was just having a bad day, they didn't really mean it. It's infuriating, and it's dehumanizing. And my job is to listen to communities of color and follow their leadership and show up when it's easier to be silent. So there's a lot of self-work that's involved in that. There's a lot of listening and saying yes when I'm told to be somewhere, and a lot of apologizing when we get it wrong. So.
Yes, and I think that's really important, because you know this whole conversation is not easy. It's very messy if you're going to be honest. And there's going to be a lot of apologizing involved. I didn't mean to hurt you. I didn't mean to. But that's the only way we get through, right? That's the only way we come to common understanding, if we come to common understanding. So thank you very much for that, Reverend Tennis. Asa Khali, Dr. King explained after the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 65, that the movement up until that time had been a reform movement. But now, in 1967, they were in the era of revolution, which meant they were called upon to raise basic questions about the dismantlement of white supremacy. King's peaceful agitation had resulted in social change. And we see this continuing with the Black Lives Matter movement, despite the propaganda that's been inflicted on it, that they're a violent organization, which they are not. But we see it continuing with the shooting of David Jones, who was shot in the back, was protested by Black Lives Matter, and it finally resulted in the officers firing. And we see it with ongoing protests in Sacramento over the Stephon Clark shooting. But it seems to me that Dr. King was one of those rare leaders who was able to combine on-the-ground activism with savvy political strategy. with his political negotiations behind the scenes. However, in this era of Trump and his loosening of basic civil rights that the civil rights movement worked so hard to accomplish, it would be challenging at least to come to the table with most politicians to effect change. So could my question to you after all of that is, could you use the same strategy Dr. King employed and be effective? If you cannot, what's changed?
Okay, that was a mouthful. Well, first, thank you for the invitation to join in this discussion with the panelists. Before I answer the question, I would like to call the ancestors who have come before us to pave the way to come into the room to give us courage to speak truth to power. To answer the question is, in fighting for justice, everything is recycled. There may just be a new name to it, maybe a new, instead of going right, you go left. Instead of going left, you go right. But black and brown people will forever in America continue to have to fight for justice and fight just for our basic humanity. The civil rights movement, it was labeled the civil rights movement, but is today you may call it Black Lives Matter. It's still under the umbrella of liberation, the entire liberation of black and brown people. To shake that stronghold of being oppressed by white supremacy. And so I do believe that you can use, first, what I'm so happy about Black Lives Matter now is that we have made room, which I have always, as an activist since I was 13, always make room for our elders because they get it. And they have wisdom that we need to incorporate this fight. And so there is a spiritual respect component to this. Yes, we need to use Dr. King's methods. His method was very effective. But we also need to use the spirit of him changing, having conversations with Harry Belafonte saying, I fear that I'm integrating my people into a burning house. You know, many people interpret that as he was feeling that he made a mistake about integration. No, he was preparing us to fight a system that he realized was never going to change. And that was revolutionary in itself. You know, it was more than I have a dream. That was a powerful speech. But if you go back to his later speeches before he died, he was speaking exactly how we are speaking and how we were acting today in Black Lives Matter movement. So again, what's old is what's new. We're dealing with a spiritual component because we're wrestling against spiritual wickedness in high places that are here to oppress black and brown and poor people. And I think that's the beauty of Martin Luther King. He was able to see the bigger picture, to see not only was he dealing with race, he was also dealing with poor, which affects all of us when we're oppressed by the system. So I think there is room to obviously learn from our elders, learn from their mistakes as well. We cannot afford to be divided, especially under Trump. We need to come together and build strong coalitions to fight against oppression. And so, yes, use that to our advantage, but also use it as a learning tool to things of what not to do and not to get caught up in certain conversations that's not going to benefit us in this struggle.
Yeah. Well put, well put. Please say your name because I don't want to...
Nijmi.
Nijmi.
Yeah.
Nijmi. That's beautiful.
Thank you.
I was going to wreck it. Nijmi. Nijmi. About 6 months before his assassination, King and the SCLC organized what King referred to as the second phase of the civil rights movement, and that was the Poor People's Campaign to address economic injustice. The aim was to rebuild America's cities, but it just didn't focus on poor black people, but it focused on all poor people. He lobbied Congress for an economic bill of rights to help the poor that would include a guaranteed annual income for all Americans, which sounds radical, but that is what he lobbied for in 1967. Last year, 13% of Americans lived in poverty. We are living in a city, Philadelphia, with a 26% poverty rate, which is the highest rate among all big cities. So, Nijmi, how is the Poor People's Campaign that you are a part of, and it's called A Poor People's Campaign, A National Call for Moral Revival, how is that a continuation of the work that Dr. King did, and how does it differ with the circumstances of the times that we live in?
Thank you, Annette. First of all, I really want to say thank you to WHYY and also NewCore for having me, and also to my co-panelists. Really, really happy to be here. My name is Nijmi Zakiya Zarinko. I grew up in Westmoreland County in southwestern PA. I've been living in Philadelphia for 26 years. And I come here as a volunteer and leader and tri-chair of the new Poor People's Campaign here in Pennsylvania. And my life's work is about doing something that Dr. King talked about. He talked about a new and unsettling force. And he said that there are millions of poor people in this country with little or nothing to lose. If they can be helped to take action together, they will do so with a freedom and a power that will be a new and unsettling force in our complacent national life. So that new and unsettling force are the people who are poor and dispossessed. And so I want to talk about the Poor People's Campaign originally, to get to your question, sort of what was then and what is now. Because I think that a lot of us don't know about it. I mean, I never learned about it in school. I don't know how many people here did. And we hear it, maybe you know it's associated with King, but we don't really know what it was. So at the end of his life, as folks have been making reference, and I appreciate what you said, Brother Asa, King and others like the National Welfare Rights Organization, and I also want to lift up the leadership of women in this as well, were making this pivot. There were three pivots, one from civil rights to human rights, one from a period of reform to a period of revolution, and one from looking at systemic racism to looking at the intersections between systemic racism, poverty, and militarism, what we call today the war economy, where half of every dollar that we send to the federal government of their discretionary spending goes into the war economy, into defense contractors and military spending. So, and we're adding a fourth one in the new campaign, which is environmental devastation. So he made these three pivots. And just a quick story from tonight, as I was being escorted over here by the gentleman at the front desk, and someone here I'm sure knows his name, but I don't know his name. What's his name?
Mr. James.
So I was walking over here with Mr. James, and Mr. James says, you know, back in 1968, a lot of white people didn't like Dr. King. And a lot of black people didn't like Dr. King either. And so, especially with this pivot where he, you know, the crux of the Civil Rights Coalition was African Americans and white liberals. And with this pivot, he was making a change into looking at how are we bringing together poor and dispossessed people across race, across all color lines and lines of division. And that was a place where a lot of people in the civil rights movement didn't want to go. They said, look, we've been looking at racism, we've been looking at civil rights. Now you want us to look at the economy, you want us to look at the war machine? That's not our business, right? And a lot of the white liberals said, we're comfortable with a situation where we're talking about, you know, supporting and working with, right, folks of color and black people, but we're not comfortable talking about class. We're not comfortable talking about the war machine. That's structural problems that don't have to do with just civil rights. So a lot of the people that were around him actually abandoned him or distanced themselves from him. And he, you know, there's speeches in which he said, look, people are going to do what they're going to do, and I'm going to do what I'm going to do. And he was assassinated before the campaign even got off the ground. And there were caravans of people who engaged in the campaign and went to D.C. and created something called Resurrection City for 6 weeks. They came from Appalachia. They came from the Southwest. They came from the North. Folks from all over the place. So 50 years later, conditions in a lot of ways are worse than they were at that time, right? So the official poverty statistics that you cited, you know, the most recent data shows us that 1 in 2 people in this country is poor or near poor. So it's not a small minority of people that is dealing with this situation or that is directly impacted. And we, in the new campaign that comes out of two national organizations, one of them is Repairers of the Breach, which you may be familiar with, Bishop William Barber II from North Carolina, Moral Mondays Movement. The second one is the Kairos Center at Union Theological Seminary. And that organization for 10 years, both of them actually have 10 years of history, even though Bishop Barber only became more well-known in the last couple years, he spent 10 years building up Moral Mondays in North Carolina. And the Kairos Center spent 10 years finding and building organizations of poor and dispossessed people and connecting us up across the country. And I was part of that process. It was called the Poverty Scholars Network. So when I was the executive director of the Philadelphia Student Union, I was taking young people from Philly down to West Virginia to look at mountaintop removal, right? And people were asking, why are you doing that, right? Why? What does that matter to kids from West Virginia? But it made a huge impact. And some of those young people now are leaders in the National Poor People's Campaign. And so we were building the campaign through bringing people together to learn about those struggles and those histories. So after that 10 years of work, now this has launched on February 5th in 40 states. So 40 states are taking up the Poor People's Campaign. You can find out about the campaign and you can sign up at poorpeoplescampaign.org. And here in Pennsylvania, we're coordinating and paving the way for everybody to get involved. We've sent out letters to over 200 organizations throughout the state. And the campaign in its first phase has two goals. The first goal is to change the distorted moral narrative, right? Right now, part of the problem is that poverty is seen as a moral failing of the individual, right? If you're poor, it's because you made the wrong choices. If you're poor, it's because you didn't go to the right school. If it's poor, it's because you're lazy. When in fact, as King said, and as he knew, poverty is produced by the system. Poverty is a structural issue. And so we're changing that moral narrative from poverty is a moral failing to poverty is a failing of the system. It's not a sin to be poor. Poverty is a sin. It's not a sin to be homeless. Homelessness is a sin. In the richest country in the world, in the richest country that ever existed. So point one is to change the distorted moral narrative, and point two is to build the independent power of organizations of poor and dispossessed people. Those are the two goals of the campaign in its first phase. And the start of the campaign will start the day after Mother's Day in state capitals, as I said, 40 state capitals in D.C., with simultaneous actions every Monday between May 14th and June 18th. And then there'll be a mass mobilization in D.C. That's the beginning. So what we're trying to learn from the original campaign is building up the leadership across the country, state by state, that's very, very clear that this movement isn't just about one leader who can be taken out. It's about building up the leadership and power of lots and lots of people throughout 40 states and counting, because new states are joining all the time, to carry forward what desperately needs to happen, to build that new and unsettling force, to get structural changes happening in this country. So I'm just very happy to be here, and I would love to connect with anyone about the campaign. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Nizmi. It was certainly information that we all could use and were unfamiliar with. I'll just speak for myself. Tamir, You probably well know this historically because you're a very bright young man. But youth of color have always been at the forefront and have been strategically used in the civil rights movement. I'm thinking specifically of the Children's Crusade of 1963, a pivotal event of the civil rights movement where youth took the lead in a series of nonviolent demonstrations which opened the eyes to the nation of what was going on. Today, we see through the courageous actions of student activists that the conversation about gun control is finally getting a wee bit of traction. At least it's getting through and being heard. And I know you're an education advocate, and I'm wondering, how can you fuse education and activism and young people to address inequality, inequity, social justice, or do you have your own ideas?
Okay, that was a great question. It's an honor to be here, and it's hard to follow you all. But I think as an activist, you have to think intensively and critically, and that's the function of education by definition of Dr. King. So if the education system isn't teaching the young person to do those things, if the education system fails our young people, which in many urban cities we see it, you get the quality of education by your zip code. So if you live in the 19142 zip code like I do, you don't receive that quality education, that quality and efficient urban education as we go by at Urbed. But I think you have to do both. We advocate for gun violence, we advocate for education, and it's all tied together because we see it in urban communities, we see it in rural communities. So I'm going to double check that I answered your question, the second part of your question at least. Can you repeat that second part for me?
Yeah, I said how do you fuse education? You answered that. Or do you have your own ideas about how to address social injustice the work that you do?
Yes, so Generation Z is doing it very well. And it's not just me, it's a whole movement of young folks that's doing it, from engaging in politics very early. So before young people are able to vote, they are already working on campaigns. They are already knocking on doors. They are already, what we say, using their Twitter fingers, because we know social media is a big way to disrupt something. So young people are doing that already. And I think following after Dr. King, following after many other activists, but also using the technology that we have at our advantage now as a way to disrupt.
Wow. I just feel like I need to try to ask a question of, these are different factions of what could be a coalition, you know, to address a like-minded issue. And so I'm just wondering, and anybody can take this, how can we come together as a coalition? And do you think that it would work? Certainly Dr. King had a coalition of activists whom he worked with. However, going forward about a decade, the Black Panthers also had a coalition of folks that they work with, and it didn't work so well. So how can we? It seems like everybody has something to bring to this movement, if you will. How can we work together to make it happen?
I think that
Reverend Metzen.
One of the ways that Dr. King was effective was he enlarged the tent. It wasn't just Black people under the tent. It was SNCC. It was CORE. It was, to some extent, the Urban League, NAACP. Not all of those organizations were on board with him, but he was inclusive, and I think the question for us today is, how can we be inclusive without blurring the lines of each organization that has something, how can we put the Black Church, Black Lives Matter, the efforts to deal with gun control under the same tent with different personalities? Somehow he was able to do that effectively and was not intimidated by it. But the minute Dr. King moved out of his lane, or the lane he was put in, the lane he was put in was stay in the South and deal with integration. When he started talking about Vietnam, if you really want to get a sense of his mind and heart, it's the sermon he preached at Riverside Church a year before he died. Not the I Have a Dream speech, which has been distorted and used by white conservatives for their agenda. But the sense in which he was able to get out of his lane, talk about the poor, talk about poverty, talk about apartheid, talking about the war in Vietnam, and that's when America turned against him, and that's when, not just Lyndon Johnson and white politicians, but the black press turned on him, black leaders turned on him, and so at the risk of having to make a sacrifice, which is what prophets do, how can we put everybody under the tent and combine these forces so that it will be such a powerful force and youth-led? Because if it's going to happen, it's got to be young people. Dr. King was 26 when he led the Montgomery. Ralph Abernathy was 27, 20, 28. Rosa Parks was in her 30s. John Lewis was 19 when he started on the freedom rides. And so when we're able to put everybody under the tent and leave personal agendas aside, what a powerful force it would be in America today.
And if I can hit...
Go ahead, Tamir.
If I can just hit on that briefly, and we talk about that tent, but I think at least for my generation and the millennial generation, I'm Gen Z.
I didn't even know there was a Gen Z, but go ahead.
we got to get uncomfortable. We have to be able to leave our safe spaces. We have to, what we use at the Science Leadership Academy is to be able to have those courageous conversations that will make you uncomfortable, that will challenge you, that will make you second guess every move you've ever made. So before we even get to that tent, we have to be able to accept ourselves, but get uncomfortable and leave that safe space. And I think once we leave that, we can build a tent and build a coalition and start a movement for generations.
You know, there's a scripture that says, how can two walk together except they agree? So in order to build the tent, the foundation of unity has to be set in order. Once that's set, we can build tents not only just here. We can build a tent over there. We can build a tent over here. We can build a tent in the South, in the North. It's about coming together. And what I've learned, and I'm a work in progress, is that I have to remain conscious, and I think all of us are getting it in the Black Lives Matter movement, that this is not about us and it's never been about us. Reminding ourselves why we do this, why we put our bodies on the line, why do we stand in front of cars, why do we stand and put ourselves at risk when police come violently towards us when we're peacefully protesting. The reminder is that our foundation was built on service, taking self out of the way and serving others. I didn't know David Jones when we protest this year and disrupted every press conference last year during the Week of Rage, from past mayors to governors, past governors to mayors to city council people, ultimately even going to the police officer's home ourselves and shutting his home down and his block. It's never been done before in any activist in here in Philadelphia. It took a lot of prayer and a lot of courage to do that. But that action, that militant action, was necessary because a week later he was fired officially. I didn't know David Jones. If he had walked by me, I wouldn't have known him. He was not a relative, blood relative to me. But it wasn't about me. It was about a person of color that could have easily been me. And I would want someone, anyone, maybe not to go to the extremes that we did, but at least to stand and say that our lives matter under that tent of unity, under that tent of coming together, under that tent of making ourselves uncomfortable, as Brother Tamir said. We're going to all have to be uncomfortable now. We have a racist bigot in office that is totally dismantling everything that was put in place to lift us up. And so this is a time, and as the Reverend said, we are forced now to build coalitions because everyone is under attack now at this point. And so that will be our foundation to build tents. You know, we have to build generational tents because I think we're going to need generational change to deal with the nonsense that this man has done generationally to fix it and bring it back. And it's going to take generations coming after me, even coming after Tamir, to really get this thing right. The young people are getting it right. I have a biracial nephew. I have a biracial niece. They get it. These young people are getting it. They realize that it's about the human specter at this point, not about the nonsense that have kept us divided. So I'm glad that my job at this present time in the Black Lives Matter movement and as an activist is to pass on what I've been taught. The same way that our elders have taught me, it's time to pass on that because we need to hold the door open so these young people can come through and really make a change and start changing things for the better because it's going to be on their backs. We're wandering in the wilderness. It's going to take the young people to bring us to the promised land.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I said that this was a conversation. A conversation is like a two-way. And so we are here not only to talk, but we're here to listen. And so I would like this to be, you guys are so polite, but I want to hear any questions or comments that you may have about, you know, the state of what's going on today within the social justice movement, your reflections maybe on Dr. King. I see some young people, but I see some people who walked in the time of Dr. King, too. And so any questions or comments that you might have, I'd like to open it up to you, sir. I'm coming back there with the mic. Wait. Stop. That's Jeanette Woods. She's going to be our running around person. Thank you, Jeanette. We appreciate it. That gentleman in the back, he had his hand raised first, and then we'll go to.
Let me say good evening, everyone.
Good evening. Good evening.
And I know I came in late, but let me tell you, I'm glad I came in at the point I came in because the information that was shared really touched on what I've been doing, you know, all of my life. I used to be a organizer with the Job with Peace campaign. And we had a campaign called Build Homes, Not Bombs. And what I'm seeing that all the efforts that we do as organizers, when it comes to fruition, it seems as though the folks who have the resources take the things that we put in place to try to help poor and low-income people, they take it and benefit for themselves. If I can give you two good examples. One, part of the campaign was we had what we called Changing, getting the military bases to become homes for low and moderate income people. And as you see, it was called economic conversion. And now it seems that those policies worked, but the economic conversion is that they are gated communities. But here we were fighting the military to put resources or change the base where low and moderate income people can have homes, and now you see who has them. So my point is, or the question I have, you know, with all these efforts and everything that we do, the second thing was the tax abatement. When they were building Liberty One, we were fighting for when you put money downtown, there's a pot of money that goes into the community. And out of that is what tax abatement came out of. So once again, resources that were supposed to go to help low and moderate income people went to help those who are gentrifying our neighborhood. So my question is, how do we stop them from taking all of the efforts and everything that we do to try to help people? They change it into a money-making greed situation where, you know, the well-to-do and rich people benefit from all the work and all the efforts that we do to try to make a difference.
It's a great question. Nizmi, do you want to tackle it?
Sure. Nizmi, thank you. Thank you so much, and I would love to learn about the history that you're talking about more. So thank you. I guess my thoughts, just to your question, one, I just feel that so much. I think you're right. It resonates with me, and that's part of the reason why we're here 50 years later, is because those things have been turned around against their original intent. And I think a couple things, not that I don't have the answers, but my thoughts on my practice is, one, leadership development. I think we engage so many people in activity without real development of leadership to understand the dynamics that you're talking about, to learn from that history, and also to understand the economic and class character of the fight that we're waging, no matter who we are. So part of what gets confusing for people is like really understanding like what are the forces that are at play and how do we defeat them in the long term and how do we anticipate what they're going to do while we learn from history, right? So to me, leadership development is one of the foundational pieces of how we have to do what we do when we do that activity. We have to be developing leaders. Everything we do, we have to do to develop leaders. And I think that's the main thing. And permanent organization, right? So here's the other piece, is that we are used to fighting these fights where we're so often we're on the defensive, right? Or so often we're mobilized, we get a victory, right? We think we get a victory, and then we demobilize. But we actually need permanently organized communities all over the state and all over the country so that we don't actually demobilize, so that we actually continue to stay organized so we can hold the people accountable for actually, you know, implementing what we got, right? And I don't think that's easy, but I also don't think it's always what we've done, and I think we need to, that's a pivot we need to make in this time, right? In addition to coming together and building coalitions, we have to learn to focus on leadership development. We're not going to get funded to do that, but we have to do it anyway. And we're not going to get funded to build permanently organized communities, but we have to do it anyway.
Thank you. Yes, right here.
Hello. My question is pretty much for anybody, whomever wants to answer it. Myself being a young woman who was head of the movement ingrained in her from my grandfather, he was in Korea, and my grandmother who has actually viewed racism with her own eyes in North Philly. Right now, I don't understand where, and this is not all young people because I have seen a lot of them walking with the Black Lives Matter activism and standing up in City Hall and different things like that, but in the suburban area where I live, It's almost as if they don't, it doesn't matter, they don't understand. And even in my own household, my sister just doesn't get it. How do you get the child to become engaged and understand that this is their plight as well as it was my grandparents or myself or my mother? How do you get them involved? Because she doesn't, they don't cover enough things in school about Black history. So I'm asking her questions about who's Madam C.J. Walker, W.E.D. Du Bois. She doesn't even know who these people are. She said to me, you know, well, that how does that affect me? Those are people that you know. I said, these aren't people that just affect me. These are people that affect you as a black girl. How do you get these young people involved?
Great question.
I guess I'll try to take that one.
Go ahead, Tamir. Go for it.
It's one because I come from a household that's not activist. I come from an older sibling that plays basketball, an older sibling that likes playing video games, and two parents that work hard just to make sure that they send three boys to college. So they made sure it was food in the house, they can work, and make sure we did our homework so that we can pass school and continue on with our lives. But it's that one thing that will allow that person to get that spark. It's that one interaction. It's the one experience, but it's the one opportunity. Many young people, and this may disappoint some people, or they may say it's a lot of things out here for us, but there's not many opportunities for us to become civically engaged. And when there are opportunities for us to be civically engaged, there's a lot of politics around being civically engaged. You have to know what way to move, how to talk, how to walk, what haircut to get, or what hairstyle to get. And when we walk into those rooms, we begin to be uncomfortable. And my generation and many others are not okay with being uncomfortable. So it's one, making that child uncomfortable. Two, taking them to those meetings that they're like, oh, this is who that person is. This is why I need to work with them. This is why I need to network with them. But also letting them meet other young people. Not me, but it's so many more young people that don't put on a suit, that does just as much work as I do, even go 10 times harder, that launch foundations and organizations that make movements, that bring in elders and younger generations. So allowing them to connect in, I'm no longer a commissioner on there, but I will connect them with the Philadelphia Youth Commission. I will connect them with the Philadelphia Student Union. I'm happy to connect them with the team that actually makes sure UrbEd stays running, because I'm just the face of the nonprofit. Those folks make sure I do my job. So I'm happy to connect them with anyone I know, but also ensuring that they connect with elders so that they can share their generational story.
You know, it's interesting, just quickly. My son is 30, so he's not young. But during the campaign, he voted for Bernie Sanders in the primary, as many people of his generation did. And then when Bernie didn't win, he didn't vote at all. And when I heard that he didn't vote, I was livid and gave him the speech that so many black parents give their kids. Don't you know that people died for the right for you to vote, for me to vote? What is wrong with you? This is not how you were raised. He said, Mom, he said, nobody was speaking to my issues. He said, nobody was speaking about how you have to work three jobs just to pay your rent, even though you have a college degree. You know, nobody was saying that. He went on with this litany of things that he thought only Bernie could solve. So we really have to, you know, engage our young people. Millennials in his age generation, I don't know, I did a story on millennials, and I can't remember the exact data, but they're the least voting group in every single age group. So you're right, Tamir. We really, really do have to find a way to engage our young people, to get them civically involved, so they feel like they have a stake in our political system.
Yes.
And then you. Yes, good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
Okay, my question is, okay, you know, 50 years later in 2018, when looking back at 1968, Okay, what areas do you think we as a society in America have made progress in, and which areas have we regressed in, you know, since that time?
What do you think, Abby?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is also what I was thinking about with the previous question, which is that I think our society is really structured around desensitizing us and anesthetizing us. So there's a whole lot of TV, and there's a whole lot of, I don't know, baked goods and alcohol and drugs and antidepressants and anti-ADHD drugs. There's a lot of things that in our culture, video games, TV, you know, like the internet, it's all designed to keep us distracted. And it's good at it. It's working. And it's keeping us from having face-to-face interactions. It's keeping us from asking real questions, having real conversations. And it's also, it's providing huge gifts to us as well. I mean, like what social media is giving to the movement right now is like astronomical. We weren't able to organize the way that Tamir is able to organize when I was a teenager. And have the wide impact that he can have. But it also really can shut us down and can keep us focused small. So that's one of the things that I wrestle with just as a kind of systemic thing, and it's capitalism that's trying to make that happen. So I think that we're less present to one another in a real and honest way these days.
That's so true. Yes.
Yeah, my name's Warren Austin. This brother right here, he hit the nail right on the head. You said something about people not agreeing. Okay, now, the actual scripture, and it depends on the translation that you read, it says a house divided amongst itself cannot stand. That means that the biggest problem is division, okay? We're talking about the black church. We're talking about the white church, okay? The church is the body of Christ if you're a Christian, okay? So that means that everybody should be joined together, okay, for one cause, okay? We can't point the fingers at one person. Now, me, I'm standing here right now. I'm a senior citizen, right? I'm probably older than everybody in here, you know? But, and the thing about it is I came up in the 50s and the 60s, okay? And I remember, okay, I'm of a, you know, mixed culture, okay? And I remember having to fight Caucasian people and my own people, okay? Because black is not a color. It's an understanding of where you came from. Okay, I say, take a glass of milk, put a drop of chocolate in it, you're black. Okay, it has nothing to do with all these other ethnic groups that are inside of you, okay? So unless people can come together, okay, and understand that it's not about religion, it's not about race, it's about humanistic belief that every person deserves the same right, okay, to be able to live, to be able to raise their families, to be able to be educated in a country that is saying that this is what we're all about, okay? Now, we argue about things like religion and this is and that, okay? We all have our different beliefs, okay? But what we have to understand is that it's not about what you believe or how much money you have. It's about, okay, if whatever you believe keeps you from knocking me in my head, keeps you from robbing me, hey, you're okay with me, okay? Now, as far as what happens to you after you die, that's a different story, and nobody's going to know that until you're dead. So why worry about that now, okay? We have to worry about helping each other, okay? As a black man, I get up every morning, and I say to myself that I'm going to set a positive example that everybody can look at me and say that I'm doing something positive, okay? I came up. I got out of high school. I went into the military. I got a job with a telecommunications company. I retired, okay? I have my own business now, okay? So I can go out and I can say to myself that even as a senior citizen, okay, I'm strong, okay, I'm proud to be a black man. I'm going to set a good example. So if somebody looks at me, they can say, this is a good man who is black, not a black man who is a good man, okay? For, you know, I want people to look at me and say, I'm doing something positive. But the other thing is we don't pool our resources together, okay? And we're not just talking about racially, we're talking about as a whole country, okay, to make sure that everybody in this country is able to eat every day, that every child in this country is able to be educated so that they can present a positive force in the world. And that's the way we have to look at it, instead of sitting down saying, okay, well, we're over here and they're over there and we're trying to fight against each other. Because the thing about it is, when you look at it, there are a lot of other ethnic groups in this country, okay, that they're not necessarily having the same problems as maybe black and white, okay, because they're pooling their resources together and they're allowing themselves to become educated and they're, you know, sustaining themselves by pooling their money together. Because a lot of times economics has nothing to do with how much money you have, okay? If you're poor, you can make $1 million. But if your liabilities outweigh your assets, you're poor, okay, because you have nothing to save, okay? And that's the other thing we have to teach our young people from the time they're in high school is how to take their money and invest it and save, okay?
Certainly, those are lots of ideas that we can unpack as we continue this discussion, but you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right about all of what you said, and it's all about unity. It's all about working together as a beloved community.
And just before you go to the question, just make sure what he said. Also, just to make sure that all of that is wonderful, but to make sure that there are jobs available to have those type of resources so you can maintain, as he said. And we do know that in this system, the odds are very much not in our favor as minority people, and certainly not as poor people who have been judged that they are lazy and that they are uneducated. You know, if you can make a dollar out of 15 cents in the hood, you can do much more than, you know, you're doing more than what someone with a PhD is doing. Believe me. And I've seen low-income mothers, single mothers of color, make miracles every day and feed their families and take care of their household. So, yeah, we all want, quote unquote, the American dream, but just make sure that dream is available to all of us.
Okay, we're going to take this one last question because it is 8 o'clock.
Oh, okay,
and we have a surprise.
Okay, I want to piggyback on your question. I'm sorry, I forgot your name. What was your name? Philip. Okay, I want to piggyback on Philip's question with a more specific question, like make it specific and ask anyone on the panel to address this. Right. So if your question was, in our society, where have we made progress and where have we regressed? So, like a cultural thing, like I just saw Black Panther on Saturday, right? And so from a cultural point of view, that was so, 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 so cool. But unarmed black men keep getting shot by the police. And I, you know, oh, this is wonderful. Oh, this sucks. You know, progress and we're regressing and just how can we, so with the regression, like how can we stop these shootings? And I don't know if that's too specific, but you know, progress and then regression like that.
I think it's fear. I think that once police stop fearing black males, then we can make progress. I mean, I tell my son all the time, I said, you know, you're a likable person. I mean, but that's what I think. I think that we have to alleviate fear. I did an interview one time with former Commissioner Charles Ramsey, and he was advocating an age-old strategy, which was community policing. He said that cops have to get out of their cruisers. They have to walk the neighborhood which they have vowed to protect and serve and get to know the people, get to know the young black man that they fear while they're in their car.
I cannot believe that people keep talking about these people that shoot us down when we have no guns, is that they fear. Where,
Because I don't think they do fear us, number one. I think a lot of it, first of all, if you really want to make change, start arresting the pigs. Excuse me, I'm about to call them pigs. Start arresting the police that shoot and kill black and brown people. That's number one. You know, I mean, Black Panther was wonderful, but we don't live in Wakanda. You understand? Listen, please, don't misunderstand what I'm saying. That's not winning because Black Panther is number one at the box office. That's not winning. That's a form of entertainment that so we won't go insane. We have to go and maybe have a Wakanda moment and then come back out because there's so many of us being murdered on a day-to-day basis. You may need a Wakanda and an Angela Bassett to come there as your mother. You understand? But that's not winning. That's not winning. So I don't put fiction and Hollywood when it comes down to the realistic of black and brown and poor people being murdered. And people like law enforcement are not being held accountable. Maybe if we started dressing like Black Panthers, maybe they stop killing us. How about that? You know? So, but that's not going to happen. So we need to put things in this perspective. We can't afford to have Hollywood moments at this point. We are battling for our lives. You understand? And this is real. I can leave here now with all the education, with all of the support here, with all the allies with me, and go right down my street, which is four blocks down to my house, and get shot and murdered. This brilliant brother here, God forbid something happened. My sisters that are here, you know, this is real. And so, you know, when we have conversations like this, it's good to talk. Talking is good. We need the conversations, but we need to lead with solutions and partnership and organize so we can tear down this system and hold folks accountable when they kill us.
Thank you.
Can I say a brief word on that too, just to chime in and speak to that as well? And thank you for what you said, because I agree with you. It's our money, right? It's our money that's going to pay the police. It's our money that's going to the jails. It's our money that's going to the court system. It's our money that's going to militarization, to detention. That money needs to be divested from militarization, from detention, from policing, and it has to be invested in education, in healthcare, and in jobs.
Amen.
Right? I mean, so that those things, those forces, those dynamics have to shift. And we need a mass movement for today that can call on and force that change to happen and not stop until it does. And I think that is the potential and the power of something like the Poor People's Campaign, which many folks who are part of the movement for Black Lives are involved with the Poor People's Campaign across the country. And it's not a new organization or a new coalition. It's a vehicle for us to take action together.
Absolutely, because when you say all Black Lives Matter, you have to include that our section, our people are suffering for poverty. You know, we, for a year now, Black Lives Matter Pennsylvania, we have fed the homeless. For 1 year we've done this. I had no idea of the suffering in Southwest Philadelphia when we set up a food table there. It broke my heart, you know, and I'm very happy that we are in the Black Lives Matter movement, are partnering now with Poor People Campaign, because it's affecting our low income, it's affecting our family members that are in the low income housing or projects. You know, it's affecting all of us in this situation. It's not just one situation with the police. You know, when we're saying Black Lives Matter, we're saying all aspects of Black lives, and that we need to make sure that everybody's need is met in our community. It's up to us. Batman, Wonder Woman, Superman, nobody's coming to save us but us. And we have to have a moral responsibility to make sure that just because it's not blood related, it's still our responsibility to take care, to love, and to support one another.
Can I say too, if we don't vote in this midterm, if we don't make our voices and power felt in the ballot box, if people had voted right, we wouldn't be in some of the condition we're in now. If we don't vote, then we have no voice. And we have to marshal people. We got young people, old people, to make a change, because if we don't make a change, it's getting going to get worse and worse and worse in America.
And I promise to be very brief, but we talked about Wakanda and the superhero and investing money in education. But it is my job, I have to say, to mention that we only have 2% of black male educators in a classroom. So if we want to be superheroes, if we want to invest in education, I need you to go open a textbook and go be a classroom teacher. Go be an administrator. Go be the things that are unpopular instead of just being a lawyer. No offense to our lawyers, it's a fundamentally important thing. But how about before they need to go see that public defender? How about that educator that's in a classroom taking time? How about that guidance counselor that's helping that student apply to college? So if you want to be a superhero from Wakanda, if you want to invest in education, if you want to start a movement, go be an educator, because 2% is not enough. 4.5% in Philadelphia public schools is not enough. So go be an educator. Go start the movement.
On that note, let's give our panelists a round of applause. This has been fantastic. Thank you so much.